You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Nearly a week after its election, Italy remains ungoverned. Is it actually governable? My guests Chiara Ramella, Daniel Bache and Thomas Lewis will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the planned summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un prompts backyard inventors around the world to speed up work on their escape pods, the story of the apparent poisoning of a former Russian spook in a usually sleepy English town finds a way to get even stranger, and what should Barack and Michelle Obama, the TV show, look like? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My studio guests today are Monocle's Chiara Ramella and Daniel Bache. And joining us from our Toronto bureau is the disembodied voice of Thomas Lewis. Welcome all. We will start tonight in Italy, the people of which still don't know who is running the country, although keen students of Italy's post-war history will be aware that this is not necessarily unusual. The Five Star Movement, which won the most seats in last Sunday's election, is now believed to be canvassing partners for a coalition, having previously said that they would never stoop to such a shabby compromise. Chiara, you return to speak on behalf of your nation. What is going on? Where are we? Five Star, it is believed, would prefer to have a coalition with the Democratic Party, but is there any reason why the PD would not be into that?
See, I love this because I think keen readers of Shakespeare will realise that this is a little bit like, I don't know, Midsummer Night's Dream, where everybody, when one person
is
loves another.
Is that one of the ones where everyone dies at the end?
No, luckily not, although that would be a risk. No, let's not go there. But one loves the other, but the other loves it not and loves another one still. So it's a bit of a triangle at the moment. As you know, the Movement Five Stars has gathered the most amount of votes, but it's a bit of a tripartite situation at the moment, where the Movement Five Stars would rather open up to the PD. The PD would not want to go in a coalition with the Movement Five Stars because much of the raison d'etre of the Movement Five Stars from the very beginning was basically to oppose the PD, and they've always put themselves in contradiction to all of the PD has ever represented, which is basically old politics and a system of entrenched power. So they are not willing to stoop to a coalition with them. But the problem with the PD and the fact that it only gathered roughly 19% of the votes, is that they'd much rather put themselves in a position of opposition at the moment, which basically leaves open way for a coalition between the Movement Five Stars and the League, the Lega, as the potential other feasible option, which would be a meeting of populist parties that I really would not recommend.
That grand coalition, if you will, of the League, the artist formerly known as Lega Nord, and Five Star, is there any way that isn't completely insane?
Well, what might happen is that they might try to form a government of intent, so-called government of intent, which is where they agree on a certain number of points from the point of view of the manifestos that they've put forward. These would most likely be something about electoral law and reform, as to avoid another situation like this happening again. And we've already gone through a lot of different electoral laws. So this would try to be a law that creates a stronger majority to begin with. And then maybe something on jobs reform, and basically just have two or three points to carry forward until new elections, essentially.
Thomas, in our Toronto bureau, is this bizarre spectacle causing the people of Canada to rejoice in their stable, stolid and frankly, generally quite tedious politics?
Well, it is fairly stable and, I guess, tedious in some ways, if you want to call it that, Andrew, at the moment. But Canadian politics does have its own kind of history of, you know, having upsets at fairly, you know, regular intervals. And I think, you know, Justin Trudeau's victory in 2015, where he won a majority government, was one of the biggest surprises of all. I think Canadians had been bracing themselves for some kind of minority government, maybe a coalition, but but kind of a political picture where there were lots of voices competing to shape the agenda. So I suppose the moment we're in, and we are sort of 3 years or so almost into the Liberal government here, you know, this kind of moment of a majority government is, I suppose, kind of a welcome one. That's not saying that, you know, more questions are being raised now about kind of the way the Liberal government is governing here, with eyes kind of looking ahead to the next election coming up. But you only have to look at some of the provincial races, say, over the past few years. In Alberta is the biggest one, which had been controlled by Conservative leaders for decades and decades. And it then opted to elect the left-leaning party in Canada, which was one of the biggest shocks in sort of provincial politics in Canada for some time. So Canada is not immune to its own sort of political tumult, not quite perhaps as colourful as it is in Italy at the moment.
Daniel, one of the amusing aftershocks of the Italian election is that there are already reports of queues at job centres, especially in the south, of people asking where they can get a form to apply for the universal basic income that Five Star promised as part of their platform, which, if it ever happens at all, is years away. Are Five Star about to be in the position of the barking dog that actually catches the car and is now expected to drive the thing? This is where it usually goes wrong for populists, isn't it? They sort of say, we're going to do all this, this and this, and then they actually win and someone says, all right then. And yes.
Yeah, the Donald Trump effect, where he's like, didn't expect to win, but now have to steer the ship. I think so, and maybe Kira can tell us. It's a country quite split in half, and things, life in the South is much different than in parts of the other country. But absolutely, now that they're in negotiations to actually lead this country, there's so many issues there. It'll be absolutely a task of having to step up and really tackle them. Migration, unemployment, all these things.
What's most interesting, I think, about the southern Italians queuing up the job centres is, I guess, in a way, a proof of the fact that a lot of people who support Movement Five Stars don't necessarily have a clear understanding of the fact they haven't even got into power yet. So the level of political knowledge of how the system works is not necessarily very widespread across the Italian electorate. And so I think it is, in a way, disappointing to know that a lot of people who perhaps don't necessarily know how the system works end up falling for this kind of things.
Interesting, in democracy, we always expect this immediate change, and we, you know, people that come from those, like, parliamentary democracy like Canada don't expect these things to happen overnight, but sometimes we do, and they don't really happen that way. And in Italy, it's going to take a long time.
Well, moving from incremental accretional change to the dramatic gesture, let us now contemplate the unlikeliest diplomatic summit in many years, possibly of all time. The scheduled encounter between an infamously thin-skinned, belligerent and volatile demagogue with weird hair, and yes, the chairman of the Workers' Party of Korea. This meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un is due to occur by May at a location to be decided. Daniel, first of all, what could possibly go wrong?
So many things here, I think. The big thing, I think, is for the way Trump carries out his foreign policy. If we get the ball moved down the field and there is progress here, Donald Trump can say, this is a successful foreign policy.
By well, he's going to say that anyway.
Of course, he's going to say it, but by being belligerent and by being in their face. I think one of the things we have to really watch here is the situation for South Korea. They have, I mean, two major issues. One is that this is all a bit of a farce and we're going to be moved into an actual war, or that the South sort of sells out their values a little bit and in appeasing the North and really trying to have progress happen.
Kiara, is Donald Trump possibly being played like one of the accordions in those weird accordion orchestras from North Korea that keep appearing on YouTube?
It depends.
That may not have been my most agile simile of all time, for which I apologise.
I don't think so. I think it is. It's in a way, this is a bit of a coup for both of them to boost their respective PR departments for Kim Jong-un. Obviously, this is a great opportunity to show after the Olympics that there is a bit of a thawing on their part. And for Trump, it's a great opportunity to prove that his hard-nosed approach was the one that was actually successful. So I'm not sure that Trump is necessarily the one who's being played here.
Thomas, what do you think? How much rests, I guess, in terms of that perception of who's playing who on where this summit occurs? Neither of these two men famously are terrifically enthusiastic travellers, but Kim Jong-un even less so than Donald Trump. This is almost certainly going to have to happen somewhere on the Korean Peninsula. And at that point, can Kim Jong-un not spin this as how, you know, he made the most powerful man on earth come to his front door begging for a compromise?
Well, precisely. I would imagine that's how you'd spin it to the state-controlled media and those images of the sort of state-employed newsreaders that we see every now and then crying and rejoicing kind of in their newscasts, if you can call them then. I think, look, you know, if it's spun that way internally in North Korea, I think, you know, the rest of the world, wherever this takes place, will see it rather differently. I think, you know, what is interesting about this is that, you know, we talk about, oh, what Donald Trump's foreign policy is, you know, what his strategy on, you know, X, Y, and Z are. I think, you know, to lots of people, it feels as though, you know, maybe what is the strategy? Is there some kind of clear, thought-out thinking, a kind of a chess game that Donald Trump kind of has for various issues? I think a lot of people, frankly, would say no. And I think, you know, there may be some people who are obviously very surprised and don't quite know how this is going to go or where it's all going to end up. But the fact
you've
got...
You've just described the entire human race there, I think, Thomas.
Well, exactly. But, you know, when you've got a president who basically is not tethered to political or diplomatic rules at all, you know, is this possibly kind of one moment of the Trump presidency where this kind of freewheeling, pretty possibly uninformed kind of view of so many areas of the world actually may be going to work, you know, to the sort of the benefit of this intractable situation on the Korean Peninsula? I think, you know, you have to look at, you know, this, that maybe being beyond the rules here might be something, however Kim Jong-un wants to play it afterwards, that actually might kind of go to the benefit. I would say, though, that this kind of, you know, rattling and thumping of the chests that took place around the time of the UN General Assembly, I just didn't really buy kind of much of this thing that, you know, North Korea was going to launch an attack. You know, we've seen for so many years that North Korea can say or do whatever it wants, basically, because, you know, China isn't going to let it collapse. And, you know, the US isn't going to launch a nuclear strike because of the chaos that would, you know, would ensue from there. So I think this obviously is a totally remarkable situation. And I wonder whether this is the one moment so far where being a total freewheeler for Donald Trump's part actually might be, you know, this might be the one positive, and this is talking obviously with a lot of caveats, but, you know, this might be the one positive moment that he's used that kind of political style to kind of a positive effect.
I mean, Daniel, what is beyond the obvious, i.e. us all still being here at Christmas, a definition of success, assuming this summit goes ahead, which I, for one, would not bet a great deal of money on?
I think the fact that no U.S. president has ever met a North Korean leader or vice versa, they've never actually met face-to-face, nor even had a phone call together. If they can get in their same room and actually talk, then that has to be a success right there. Perhaps North Korea is really on its knees and can't sustain life there anymore because of the sanctions, or perhaps it's a game, who knows, but in any case, they're going to be actually speaking.
Kiara, is this the unlikeliest imaginable pairing of two people to work together to solve a problem?
Possibly. Although I must reveal that we were asked to prepare a little bit of a pairing of our own, of a bit of an unlikely pairing that we believed could potentially outdo this. Now, I don't think the one that I'm going to prepare to present is going to outdo this, but it definitely is number one resolution of a rivalry in my mind. Being a 90s child, I think this is going to bring the tone of the discussion a little bit down, but I think a Spice Girls versus All Saints face-off would be a pretty tense diplomatic moment. And it would bring great joy to me, especially as it would mean a rejoining not only of the Spice Girls, but of the All Saints too.
Daniel?
Well, my example last week of President Putin and George W. in Chilean ponchos, I thought that was a pretty good unlikely pairing.
It's not that likely. Thomas, did you think of any sort of, I guess, Canado-Welsh hands across the border or something else?
There are so many of those, but I think more interestingly, there's a lot of coverage in the US press today about the cameo role of Nancy Pelosi on a particularly popular drag show talent competition on US television last night. She was brought in by RuPaul, probably the most famous drag queen in the world, to meet the would-be drag queen hopefuls. And I think it was kind of interesting that maybe it's a bit of a risk for Nancy Pelosi kind of doing this. Obviously, it's very much playing to her base. She was pitched by RuPaul as this, you know, a champion of LGBT rights throughout her long political career. I suppose when you look at sort of the tone of US politics or the way it's described, kind of the narrative of it anyway, that it's a pretty sort of divided one at the moment. I wonder whether, say, appearing on a program like that, which is wildly popular within a very particular segment of the US TV watching population, I guess, whether that kind of entrenches her in one camp, in her sort of, you know, preaching to the choir, if you like, but actually distances her further from the other side of the political spectrum.
See,
it's quite fun anyway.
I was going to suggest a teaming up between Donald Trump and the defensive secondary of the Seattle Seahawks, notwithstanding the recent departures of Bennett and Sherman, of course. We are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Chiara Ramella, Daniel Bache, and Thomas Lewis. Coming up next, Salisbury. It just gets odder and odder and odder.
The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns for a fourth year, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality. Whether you're an architect, city maker, retailer, media mogul, or chef, pick up a ticket and be part of the debate on upping quality of life across the board. This year, there will also be a special focus on entrepreneurship and making it in the city. We'll be diving headlong into all Zurich has to offer, from fine food, Swiss wine, and river swims, to private tours of the best shops and ateliers. So why not join us from the 28th to the 30th of June? Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Chiara Ramella, Daniel Bache, and Thomas Lewis. And let's look at the UK, specifically at Salisbury, where a story that started out pretty weird has somehow succeeded in getting even stranger. While former Russian intelligence officer Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia recover from an apparent attempted poisoning, 21 other people were also injured, more than 180 British troops have been deployed to Salisbury, mostly specialists in decontamination and chemical warfare. Digging also appears to be occurring at the Salisbury Cemetery, where Colonel Skripal's wife and son have been buried in the last couple of years. Daniel, first of all, how clear an understanding do we actually have of what on earth has occurred here?
I think there is a good understanding of what happened to these people. Will the British government establishment police let us know? I'm not so certain. They came out and said this was a nerve agent, and clearly what that implies is it's not exactly easy to get your hands on this type of things, and for it to happen on British soil is quite extreme and odd, as you say. But will we get a better understanding other than, I mean, the general go-to these days seems to be just like, oh, we can blame Russia because Russia must have been involved in hacking or doing this or poisoning people.
It seems a reasonable bet, in fairness.
It can do. And who else could have that capacity? And considering the ties of the past, I mean, just what an odd story. And I think I referred to it the other night as is sleepy Salisbury, and I'm sorry to the people in Salisbury. I'm sure it's a lovely place, but for it to happen,
it is a nice town. It rarely, however, appears in global headlines.
Yeah.
Kiara, what have you made of the official responses? Because this is a tricky one for the British government to negotiate, because no one, as far as we know, yet knows for sure who did this or why they did it. Obviously, there are links to Russia, but Britain has to be, or British officials have to be very careful about how they play this, don't they?
Of course they do. And I mean, Theresa May has said that they will do the right thing. I think what's interesting is also to look at the Russian response to the way that the British are handling this. I mean, I'm going by the Russian embassy's Twitter feed, which admittedly is not necessarily the only mouthpiece of the Russian.
They seem to enjoy their job, those guys.
Although, exactly. It is quite telling in terms of the tone that they take the discussion down on. And they have been comparing this investigation to what had happened already in the past and following the Litvinenko script, they say. And they accuse basically the British government of just saying that all the information is classified, that Russia has no access to the information and to its credibility. So I think the British government will have to play this very carefully, but also not allow for any spinning of the perspective from the point of view of the Russians either.
Thomas, surveying this circus from the other side of the Atlantic, has it become a massive international story yet?
Well, it is being covered quite extensively here in Canada, and the US press is picking up on it. Also, I think, if you are looking at this from afar, it is pretty extraordinary that you can go to a beautiful, sleepy cathedral town that, as you say, never hits the headlines ever, and find two people slumped on a park bench who have been exposed to what appears to be some of the most lethal sort of, nerve agents or whatever that, most lay people would never sort of even have cause to consider or know about or think of. And there they are, apparently having been, an attempt on their lives, kind of being made in a public place, it seems. I mean, it is pretty extraordinary. I mean, I remember in 2006 when Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned by polonium in a London hotel, then the coverage then was of total disbelief that, someone, again, apparently on behalf of the Russian government, it appeared at the time, that could walk into a very high-end London hotel, put polonium in someone's cup of tea, and then there we go, job done, get on a flight back to Russia, and no more ramifications came from it. I think that's where much of this current case, lots of the eyes will be turning to the Litvinenko situation about 12 years ago, in that, what really happened after that. I mean, the British government obviously expressed its outrage, but what actually changed after that? Well, I don't think many people would say much did, really, in terms of the kind of the clout or the strength that the UK was able to publicly, at least, kind of show towards Russia, which has obviously, it seems, if all this comes, is born to be true, has continued to see this as a tactic. It's it's at its disposal to deal with those people that it deems to be enemies of the state. I think when you look at sort of spy cases here in North America, I can't think of any as sort of brazen as the one taking place in Salisbury at the moment. But I think, is there a nervousness about kind of espionage and spies kind of infiltrating kind of societies here? Yes, absolutely. There's been some coverage here in Canada about the Chinese kind of intelligence agency's presence here, for example. And that comes at a time when Canada really is trying to forge much deeper relations with China, both economically and in other ways too. So, yes, it is getting a lot of attention, and I think it's mostly in terms of can't quite believe that this has taken place so brazenly in such a sleepy place in broad daylight by all accounts.
Well, we will doubtless be following that story across our programming as more comes to light. But finally tonight, for most of the history of the United States, a tradition has generally obtained among its former presidents that, give or take, writing in the odd score-settling, self-justifying memoir, they get off the stage. President Barack Obama may prove, and not for the first time, an exception. He and the former First Lady, Michelle Obama, are reportedly in talks with Netflix to produce a series of programs. Details of what these programs might actually contain are scant, but it is unlikely to be much like The Osbournes, although I'd watch that. Kiara, how much are we looking, first of all, not so much to the programs themselves, but to, because there's at least one viewer they will definitely have, Donald Trump's tweeted capsule reviews of it?
I really, really would like to see that very, very, very much. No, I think what's interesting is that the one thing that they've made a point of saying already is that it's definitely not going to be just a response to Trump's activity in the White House.
Oh, that's now, a shame. I mean, that'd be brilliant. I mean,
although I do think that...
Just a weekly program called Here's What You're Doing Wrong.
But if any
Here's
of
how I'd have handled this. It'd be great.
If any of you has been following the output of... Barack Obama's official photographer, Pete Souza. I think many of us often look to Pete Souza's pictures that he posts on his Instagram, for example, as an alert as to know what Trump is doing wrong in the White House. So I think in a way, this could become a little bit of an extension of Pete Souza's output, where you don't necessarily respond to what Trump is doing in an obvious way, but you just lead by example, I guess, or counter example in a retroactive sense.
There is a serious question here, though, Daniel, and it is the one about what is an appropriate amount of public attention to try and command once your time is up. And I actually think that the general tradition is pretty much a good one. You had your run, your time's up, off you get.
Yeah, I think there's, though, incredible value in learning from the experience of these leaders. I never expected Obama to take the sort of George W. Bush route of, opening a library and then taking a painting and nobody ever hears from you. But Obama, I think this has been very carefully managed. There's the new documentary about his final year and his lasting impact, which, Donald Trump is dead set on undoing all of those things, as we know. But Obama was quiet for a while, and now it's I think it's going to be carefully crafted as he tries to first show off that legacy, but then show what his real experience and impact was, yeah.
I mean, Thomas, how much of an extra... I mean, not that Barack Obama was ever going to require much help to do pretty much whatever it was he wanted to do next, but how much of a boost has he been given, or has his legacy been given by what has followed him?
Oh, well, I think undoubtedly it has. And that's why I think Daniel used the phrase carefully crafted there. That's why I think that this kind of current chapter of the Obamas' kind of post-White House life might turn out to be a bit of a masterclass in how kind of leaders who are out of office, deal with kind of the interest and the demand kind of in them, and the contrasts with, as you say, the leader who came after them. I think you look at the portraits that were unveiled at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C., a few weeks ago. Again, very, very bold choices, both in terms of the artist they chose and the way those artists decided to render their subjects in a way that we haven't seen presidents and first ladies rendered before. And I think, you look at this podcast that's being broadcast by the public radio station in Chicago at the moment, looking at Obama's Chicago years. Obviously, President Obama gave an interview to Prince Harry right at the end of last year. He's really choosing kind of these kind of vehicles to speak and to get his message out, not to be explicit about, what he thinks about the incumbent in the White House now, his successor, but just to sort of, I guess, kind of keep his kind of name out there. I mean, I don't think the Obamas are a sort of, I don't think all of these are necessarily vanity projects. And that's why I think kind of what makes them kind of quite interesting, that they're tapping into a realization that there is still a huge appetite for them. And yes, a lot of that appetite is coloured by President Trump and, his cohort in the White House at the moment. But I think the way they are curating their presence, their public life, if you like, now, really is quite interesting. And I think it is carefully crafted. There's no mistakes here. There's nothing spontaneous about this. There is a reasoning to all of it. And I think it is really quite interesting to watch. And this Netflix program, whatever it turns out to be, I think, again, will be equally controlled, as Daniel said, and equally crafted. But we'll have some kind of message message that the Obamas want to put across nonetheless.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Thomas Lewis, Daniel Bates, Chiara Ramella, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900, The Menu with Marcus Hippie. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Yeah.